In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around potential targets such as military bases and chemical plants may be advised to evacuate.
All right. Welcome, Sublation Media viewers. It's I, Douglas Lane, author of Bash Bash Revolution, and apparently Boomer. I was hanging around in the wrong stream for about 5 minutes thinking that I was waiting on Ashley when, in fact, she was waiting on me here in this stream. Ashley, welcome back to the stream. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. This week we had a premiere of a clip from a documentary on Sublation Media channel, which looked at, well, what reminded me quite a lot of Kenan Malik's Quest for a Moral Compass. So I went back and had a reread of that book, and I realized that I have not had a unique thought in my head because, you know, do you ever have these books where you read them and you don't so much remember them or think about them, but absorb them into who you are? This is one of those books. And anyway, so I thought I would pull out some of the ideas there to think about what's left when we lose God.
Oh, right. Yeah, because for people who haven't watched it yet, we should probably put a link in the chat. We're going to be discussing David Steele's 29-minute film. It's from his documentary, How We Got Here. We premiered the core of it, I think. And it was launched on Saturday. Afterwards, there was a discussion with patrons and others who wanted to think about the loss of truth, postmodernity, the death of God with David, which is really, it's what his book and film are about. And I want to hear from you, Ashley. What was it that brought you to Kenan Malik? What's his name again?
Kenan Malik.
Yeah.
Well, you know, me and Kenan Malik go way back. So I've actually met him, but I came across his work when I was an undergraduate. And the first book of his that I read was The Meaning of Race. And this book had such an incredible and profound effect on me. I mean, I had studied sociology and anthropology. I was in Canada at the time. That was my degree. And I was a forerunner, I like to think of being ultra woke, especially around that time. You couldn't come out of any of these degrees without being incredibly woke. And especially being like, I look super white today, but yeah, especially being of Indigenous descent, like being Ojibwe, you know, you had this card that you could play. And it was quite tempting to kind of pull on this victim narrative and embody it fully and think about narratives of utter difference and the unbridgeability of that difference is somehow progressive. And then I read Kenan Malik's The Meaning of Race, and it sort of, and this wonderful universalism that was the first time I'd ever come across it. And it completely inoculated me against that from that day forward. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in my new book, I draw on The Meaning of Race and the kind of, and I make the same argument for, so Malik makes the argument that race emerged as a way of making sense of our societies. He doesn't use these words, the words I use, but inability to bridge the chasm between what is and what ought to be. So you have this promise of, you know, the French Revolution, this sort of thing of modernity, of enlightenment, of equality, fraternity, and so on. But when you look out into the world, you don't see that. And that requires an explanation. And, you know, Marx and so on, the explanation is in society. There is an impediment within the very structure of society. Its proper functioning leads it to undermine its own values, its own ideals. And we have to have another revolution to overcome this. It's there, it's possible, humans are doing it, we will get there eventually. And then you have another narrative that comes up that says, no, the chasm, the void is in us. It's in human beings, it's in our nature. It is the nature of human difference that leads to differences and inequalities in the world. And this becomes racialized and biologized. And so that's the argument that he makes in that book. And I make the same argument with regard to therapy culture. Like, why do we keep seeing these therapeutic fads? And I sort of explore in great detail what the therapeutic fads say about the human subject. And I say, like, instead of what happened with race is that some aspects of humanity were raised up and the rest were thrown down into the void. What we've done now is we haven't raised everybody up. We've given up on that. We've thrown all of humanity down into the void. You're not special. You know, white people are actually horrible. And like, you know, we don't deserve dogs, all these sorts of ideas that, you know, animal, that it's become progressive to say, to knock humanity down a few notches. So all of these things that were said about other quote unquote races, we now say about humanity in general, and this becomes progressive. And so I say, like, therapeutic discourses, they narrate this misanthropy. They narrate this persistent inability to bridge what is with what ought to be. And that dislocates the cause of that from society onto the self, onto human nature, all human nature. All human nature is defunct. It's irrational. We were wrong to ever think that humans could be rational, etc. So that's the argument that I make in that book. But in, not to go on and on and on, but in Malick's Quest for a Moral Compass, which is very funny. I read this book to my baby. I read this, it's like, I don't know how many words, it's a huge book. And when my first daughter was born, I read it out loud next to her cradle. and so I have like a very fond connection to this book. But he basically talks about how throughout most of human history, our relationship with fate was sort of fixed. That we were sort of thrown about by forces beyond our control. Even for the gods, it's funny because when I was writing my book, I wanted to talk about this. So I was like, where the hell did I read? Even the gods in ancient Greece were subject to fate. And it was in Malick's Quest for a Moral Compass. I opened it today. I was like, Ashley, it's right there. Mm-hmm. I was like rereading Hegel and stuff. It's in Hegel as well. But anyway, and he says, you know, even the Greeks were, you know, even they projected obviously humanity onto the gods, and even the gods were subject to fate because they couldn't imagine. You know, they were content. Hegel says they're content with what is because there's no ought to be. There's no, at least there's no ability for human beings to fully control these forces, you know, like earthquakes and famines and this sort of thing. They had sort of unprecedented control for humans at the time, but they were still subject to fate. And this is reflected even in their ideologies. What happens is over time, our ideas of what humans are and our potential are gradually... They are attached to God initially, right? So in Christianity, you have this equality under God. And hence you can have these discussions in early Christianity about like, oh, do non-Christians even have souls? You know? So God kind of dictates equality. And over time, it kind of detaches even from God. But it's now, we're now living in a world where it's detached from everything. Morality is detached from everything. Equality is detached from everything, and we're sort of set adrift. There's no anchor for meaning. There's no anchor for these things. And so when I was, that's sort of what came into my mind when I was watching David Shields' documentary, where he begins with like the death of God sort of. And it's, this is where we are now when we're trying to forge a new morality without the old anchors.
Right. And in that documentary, he I think is mourning the passage of the 90s and early 2000s, and maybe even the 80s as well, where the idea of the death of God, the idea of the loss of meta-narratives, the idea that we could do without universal truth seemed to have a liberatory or emancipatory potential, that they, you know, this was the era of postmodernity as a left-wing project, or is thought of as in that way. And he's noting in the documentary that the relative moral relativism and the need for interpretation, the kind of the idea of standpoint epistemology, maybe even all of that is taken up by the Trumpian right. And by the end of the documentary, he's, you have this montage of headlines and clips and photos of Trump and claims of fake news and the lies of the Trump campaign or administration, and how difficult those lies are to combat in an era where the truth has slipped away. The very concept of truth has slipped away. We had like a Zoom call after, and I took like two clips from it, and I thought maybe I'd play one of the clips, and you're in it. You're in the clip. So
it,
unfortunately, not, there's no visual. I was surprised no one turned their cameras on.
I know, but there was like a, I think we thought it was just going to be audio only. So there was a little domino effect of everyone's cameras going off. Apologies for the poor visual, but let's hear the clip.
You can see people's names. Here we go.
Maybe to kind of like flesh out a little bit more, and I'm curious what, if this resonates, Dan, but that, well, you know, in the absence of trying to overcome capitalism, it's just objectively true that there's no alternative. You know, sure, a bunch of people can, you know, imagine a better world and say, wouldn't it be nice if we lived in, you know, luxury gay space communism? But if, you know, if there's, you know, not an attempt to, you know, make capitalism transient, then it is just objectively true that this was like, you know, the terminus of the species. And I think Ashley was talking about it more in that way, that we just kind of like upset, we just, you know, the consensus of global politics is just accepted, right? Well, obviously there's going to have to be some casualties, and the unemployment rate's going to be around this, and, you know, there's going to be, you know, which is, you know, it's just politics. It's just the necessary, you know.
Yeah, we can't afford all these old people. You're just going to have to die. That's Matthew Parrish's article in the Times today, like literally says, so what if terminally ill people feel nudged toward death? So what if people whose lives are expensive feel like it's their duty to die? Maybe they should, you know, because we all know this is it. This is it. And if it becomes between your expensive life and this awful machine, well, get into the machine. But I don't mean that. When I said there's no alternative, I think that there has to be an alternative, but I'm saying that that's what's been accepted. That's the sort of hegemony, that's a hegemonic ethos of our time. There is no alternative, so you best go die if you don't fit in.
Dramatic stuff. Do you think that the loss of truth, the loss of a realm of moral understanding that comes with a sense of truth, or the, you know, the death of God, has led us to this moment of euthanasia as an official policy of the state, Ashley?
No, not necessarily. Like, there are a lot of arguments that say that Christianity was necessary for atheism, you know, that this was sort of a necessary step that placed humanity at the center. And therefore, which what allowed us ultimately to have a kind of humanism, or at least monotheism, maybe not just Christianity. The sort of monotheistic religions allowed us to make that step. So I'm not, and what I was saying at the beginning, there were a few comments as well. People were saying, wait, hold on a second, we don't need God for morality. No, I'm not saying we need God for morality. I'm saying that this is the quest for a moral compass is people gradually losing God as their moral compass and fate as the limit. And presented with this kind of openness and this openness of possibility at the same time as we don't really have, or we have not been able to take hold of that potential for the openness of possibility. Another really good book that you more become and absorb rather than read is Marshall Berman's All That a Solid Melts Into Air. And that's another one of those books where after I wrote something, I opened it up and there were all of my wonderful thoughts that I thought I was so brilliant for thinking. And one of them was an open subject means an open future. That if what it means to be human, we come to realize is powerfully open, then the future is also powerfully open. That it's, if we are not, if what we become and what society is and its structures and so on are not determined by nature or by God, then we are open. Our future is open. The path before us is incredibly open. But the problem is, what happened in the 20th century is we confronted that reality, that realization, for the first time, and the result was the Holocaust, gulags, Nazism, fascism, this sort of thing. And there's a line in C. Wright Mills' Sociological Imagination, where he says, in our time, we have realized that human nature, or the limits of human nature, are frighteningly broad, frighteningly broad. So this openness of humanity in the future became this fear. Oh my God, throughout most of human history, we thought that we would come to the edge of a cliff and something would stop us from toppling over the edge. Maybe like the angels of our better nature, God, something. And there was nothing stopping us. And we just started throwing each other over the edge. And that was a really sobering and terrifying thing. So it's not just, it's not the death of God. It's this realization of an openness to the future at the same time as, you know, this realization of the human hand on history, that it was just us all along, and the destructive force that that wrought, that leads us then to deny human responsibility, to package it away, to say, no, 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 this is just the way that it is forever and ever and ever. It's actually just our nature. It's just something within us that prevents us from taking, we aren't, human nature isn't open. The future isn't open. This is it forever and ever and ever. And that's kind of what I was trying to get at in that clip, mm-hmm. that there is no alternative has become the belief of our times. That is the limit that we live within. There, it simply is no alternative to capitalism. And most people tacitly accept that. It's certainly well outside the Overton window to say anything remotely, to suggest even remotely that there is an alternative to capitalism. And so, you know, I mentioned in the clip what had been on my mind, which was assisted dying. And it's amazing how people reach for that. That it's, you know, there was one person commenting, you know, because I wrote an article in Unheard about it, responding to Matthew Paris's column in the Times on Saturday. And there was one guy like, well, and then what's your solution? You know, like, you know, you got, all you got is critique, but what's your solution? I mean, imagine that. Killing people. Well, if you're not going to kill people, what's your solution then, big shot? You know, mm-hmm. that we would be at that kind of point. And that is the end result of that logic of no alternative. I also have an idea floating around in the back of my mind that I haven't really fleshed out. I probably fleshed out at some point in my life, but it's fading for me now. But that we are seeing the resurfacing of a lot of this deeply anti-human, these deeply anti-human kind of policies and so on, in the guise of compassion, autonomy, humanism, this sort of thing. And I think it's because we have never been able to overcome this basic contradiction that of like this, and first of all, the basic contradiction between the present and the future, that we are unable to sort of move forward into the future. So we have to maintain the present at all costs. And if you don't fit into the machine, well, then there's the door, or you can fit into the machine. And which is amazing because, you know, if you look at the core of Marxism, seeing the eventual emancipation of humanity from work, you know, seeing the increasing, seeing that human labor was becoming more and more superfluous to the labor process, gave us a glimpse of the future emancipation of human labor. Instead, the increasing superfluity of human labor to the labor process becomes a reason to eradicate it, to eradicate the useless humanity, and to not even be able to see, like, well, why would you want to keep living? It should be like a great thing that you live for, like in Matthew Paris's article, I think it's Matthew Paris's article, he talks about how so many people are living so much further beyond retirement now. We just can't afford this. So like, fucking off with them. You know, come on, hasten up, out the door, at the door. That should be a wonderful thing. You know, that human beings can live for so long beyond their usefulness to the machine and enjoy life and live freely. At least we have that potential. And yet that becomes a problem that requires this dark solution. Anyways, that was quite a tangent, but the point is that it's not the death of God that leads us to this situation. The death of God opened the door to a kind of, well, the death of God was kind of symptomatic of an opening. But when we tried to walk through that door, it led us to hell.
Well, the reason why the death of God is so often referenced when it comes to the loss of morality or the loss of truth is because dogmatic religious presuppositions provide an admittedly unjustified form of certainty. If you want to know what the truth is, you turn to the Bible or to the Quran or or to your minister or priest. But if we don't have that kind of dogmatic reassurance from a religion as to what the truth is, then we are stuck with questions like this one from Dr. Foreman, where he says, Doug, please define your terms. What are you referring to when you speak of truth? And I would say that what I want to avoid is the kind of truth that you can simply define and be done with. Something I want to avoid, a reification of reality. I want to have a truth that includes what is untrue, a dialectical form of truth. I know that I sound like a flim-flam man at this point, but I think I can point to what I mean. The truth is, for instance, that we have overcome starvation and famine in the world. But the truth is also that we have not overcome starvation and famine in the world. In other words, we have the capacity to feed everyone. We have more than enough to meet the needs of all human beings, even at the great level of population that we're at right now, and perhaps well into the future, into ever increasing supply of human beings. We can meet those needs, but we do not do so. We cannot do so at the same time. So we have the resources, but they aren't adequately distributed. And the problem may lie beyond just the problem of distribution. Another truth would be that human beings are innately free, even though everywhere they are in chains. Those are the kinds of truths that I would want to point to. I know they're not adequate, and that's not an adequate definition, but I would just start by saying the truth has to be take up some aspects of the world that are not yet true, things that are not yet too true but are potentially true, or that are somehow present in what is true.
So this is the conclusion that Canon Mallet comes to as well in Quest for a Moral Compass. He says that truth is a moving goalpost, and it's intimately linked with possibility. So what is true today, just demonstrably true today, will not be true tomorrow. So for instance, it was true, I don't know, at the end of the 19th century or maybe earlier than that, let's say 1,000 years ago. It is true that the nature of a woman was to, you know, X, Y, Z, raise your children, et cetera, et cetera. And this was, it appeared ingrained in nature. And to a certain extent, it was, in the sense that there wasn't a possibility to overcome that at that time. As possibility opened up, so you've got the Industrial Revolution, you get people thrown away from the things that had tied them to nature and to a hierarchy, to a structure that determined who they were and their fate. As that all started to crumble, new possibilities open up, and we start to have completely new ideas of what it means to be human, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, etc. And this continues on now toward the present. So what was true in the past is no longer true, but it was not something that could be changed at that time. The structures of possibility simply weren't there. So now, you know, what is true today may not be true tomorrow, in the same way of what we think is normal and natural and so on. And so, yes, truth is linked to possibility. It's a moving goalpost because human beings create these structures that are dynamic and change, and that makes us dynamic and changing beings. Now, of course, there are other things that, oh gosh, where is this? I'm going back to my PhD now. What are things that are epistemically, oh God, was it Searle? But we don't need to go that deep, okay? I do recognize that, you know, there are other things that are, you know, not true in this sort of relative kind of way, right? And I think it's kind of a mistake when people take, you know, or here's a simpler version, and actually it contains Searle. Ian Hacking's Social Construction of What from 1999. This really excellent book that kind of goes, okay, folks, hold on a second here, because everyone was like, well, if being a woman is socially constructed, maybe space is socially constructed. And the point is, you know, not that the actual like things out there in the world are socially constructed. It was that our ideas of them were. But human beings are not like space, are not like tulips, are not like roses. You know, human beings, when we create categories, they interact back on who we are and what we become. You can create a million categories for a rose, and it doesn't change what a rose is unless it changes the way human beings interact with roses in some way, and we're able to do that. Mm-hmm.
I want to jump in on that point. On the point around space, about the social construction of space. One of the early books that I read in response to podcasting. So like I started podcasting, interviewing a bunch of people, and was led to read Henri Lefebvre's The Production of Space. And I was very interested in this notion that what we had to do as revolutionaries was create a new kind of space, a new way of interacting in, moving through, and understanding the world. And then I read Henri Lefebvre's Production of Space as far as I could at the time, and realized there was a lot in it that I was critical of right away, but also that I was missing, that I couldn't quite take up. But I do think it's worth pointing out that there's a difference between even Lefebvre's notion of the production of space and the construction of space. That social construction tends to, I think, emphasize culture and language rather than material productive practices and the kinds of social practices that we have that are not merely cultural. So that might be a distinction between social construction and historical materialism, is that historical materialism isn't simply a matter of going out and taking up some dirt and figuring out what its component parts are, and that now you're a materialist, but rather it includes both our productive activity and the way that it changes our relationship to the natural world and to each other.
Yeah, but of course, this is mediated by knowledge and culture and all of these things, which are themselves material and part of the world. So this is the, I've been name dropping a lot of books today, I don't know why, but because this is such a, we wound up being, having such a deep conversation. I feel like if you would like to read more about this, see. Jakubowski, not sure how to say it, Ideology and Superstructure and Historical Materialism. And what he brings out from Marx's work there is the fact that being is social being, that humanity is the objectivity of the universe, that we are subject and object. We are both subject and object. That's the point that he makes there. And in a recent podcast, when I was talking, talking about assisted dying with Kevin Newell on my channel, I was reading from Martin Hagelin's This Life, where he talks about secular morality. And he puts forward this idea that you have to have a notion of human life as finite, as central to our morality, that it matters that what we can anchor morality into is the finitude of human life. It matters because it could slip away. And when we say that something is valuable, it's because we want it to continue. We recognize that it can't continue forever, and we want to hold on to it for as long as possible. In heaven, that's not the case. It goes on and on and on forever. And that is in non-secular morality. It's just there forever and ever and ever. So what does it matter if you sacrifice a child to God, because you will be reunited with the child in God? But if there's nothing beyond this, then the human life becomes central to all morality. And it was very interesting. And I have to say this because I'm a stupid, proud mom and I'm such a cliche, but my kids were playing and I read them whatever I'm reading every night. So it's just to hear my voice while they're falling asleep, but apparently it rubs off a little bit. That's what I like to think. And my kids are playing in front of me as I had been recording this podcast. I'm thinking about it and I'm thinking, I'll excerpt from Hagelin's This Is Life. My kids are playing with their dolls and the dolls are having this deep conversation. It seems like a very deep conversation. They're 5 and 7 years old. And I jokingly say to my 5-year-old, "Hey, Liana, what's the meaning of life?" And they ignore me and they keep playing. They start fighting with each other. And my older daughter says, "Well, do you even know the answer? What's the meaning of life?" And she goes, "Oh, of course I do. It's us." And I was like, "What?" And I'm like, "No one will believe this." So I had my phone in my hand. I hit record. I said, "Liana, can you say that again?" And she says, she's very annoyed because it's all very obvious to her. She says, "The meaning of life is us." I was like, "What do you mean, like us in this room?" She goes, "No, us in the world." And then she yells at her sister because they're like playing with each other, and she sat on her hair. And she goes, and she's like, "Tulas, get off my hair." And my other daughter goes, "So the meaning of life is Tulas, get off my hair." And she goes, "No, it's human beings." And that I was like, my offspring.
yeah. Nicely born, indoctrinated kids.
So natural I did... born Marxist. But the point is that's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's only us. Only we give meaning to the world. We are subject and object that come together. We are both the subject of human activity, and we are the object of human activity. We are its outcome. So it's not that all of these things are kind of separate, that there's this world of material reality. And if you're talking about social construction, you're just an idealist or whatever. And this is how you wind up becoming a vulgar materialist, is that you will sort of, "Oh, I shouldn't be talking about culture. Well, let's go find what's in the material world that will explain this." You can't do that. I'm sorry. And if people have been listening to this podcast for a long time, you will have heard me say this 1,000 times, but Engels says all history must be studied afresh. All history must be studied afresh. You cannot simply assume the nature either of culture or of economics. That our culture, our words, are the way that we are trying to explain the world. We are telling stories about the world. We are in the world. We are interacting with it. And it is reflected in our minds, in our ideas, as we try to make sense of it and understand it. And you have to dig down through those layers of understanding to get at anywhere near what might be something material happening that we are engaging with and trying to explain. You can't, first of all, you can't take culture given, like, this is what people believe, and be like, "Oh, this is what people believe." Well, what is it? You got to figure out, like, what is actually the cultural narrative being? It's often not what you think it is. The cultural narrative you think you're attacking is often the straw man. It's the simplest one. It's the one you want. It's often something else. There's a whole, like, and then there's other material phenomena that come into play as well, like organization and how people will take hold of a particular idea. It's not just everybody in a culture that believes something. It's people within a particular class, and da-da-da-da-da. And so I reject this idea that social construction is just about, culture and language have this causal power and we forget about material reality. No, you have to dig down and understand what culture is trying to explain before you can get to that material reality. And again, I'm sort of plugging my podcast here, but I put out a podcast this week. I'm very proud of it. It's with Joel Best, who is just such a massive influence on me. He's like the theorist on social problems. And in part two, I've got another part coming out as well. But I was looking at, like, why do lies travel faster than the truth? And the answer is because lies tell a good story. Lies tell a good story. They're good storytelling. They're, you know, Oscar Wilde says you should never let the truth get in the way of a good story. And when we are studying these things, yes, we should search for the truth. That is where there's some deviation between what is happening and what people are saying. But we shouldn't let the truth get in the way of figuring out why it is such a good story. What are people trying to explain? What are people narrating about the world? What critique is being voiced that can't be and when I say critique, I'm not saying it's a good thing necessarily. It could be like a totally stupid critique. But what critique is being voiced through a lie, through a story, through a conspiracy, through something? What is said that can't be said elsewhere? So I use the example of injection spiking in the podcast. And I think, well, I won't spoil it. You go and watch my podcast and you tell me what. But it was articulating a fear in society that could not be said otherwise.
I wanted to run another clip that I think comments upon or elaborates on this distinction that is maybe a non-distinction between social production and social construction, or the distinction between ideology and material social relations. Danny talks about it here in the conversation with David Shields about his documentary and upcoming book, how we got here. Here's
the kind of world in which we relate in ought to be, you know, changeable and something that can develop and overcome itself through reason, through like talking to people and communicating on the same wavelength, so to speak, as my mom says to me, right? She's like, are we communicating on the same wavelength? And I bring that up because, you know, to the degree that there's going to be politics, David, I'm glad you brought up the FDR point about I welcome their anger, which is that then why would you get this kind of, you know, resistance to official truth in the realm of politics? Because what's driving politics is some sense of something wrong, as Clint was getting at, and hence the need to change things. And so it's already priming people to expect they're lying to you, right? Like, you know, just this phrase that we have colloquially in language, like they, the powers that be, the conspiracy, something kind of like that. It's not like one side of the American political spectrum. In a lot of ways, politics is kind of demagogical by its nature, that you're going to kind of rile up, you know, masses of people to say, here's what's wrong with the other side, or, you know, we have to overcome some kind of vested interest. And there was a hope in the 18th century that actually we were overcoming the need for politics altogether, for everybody, not like for elites, like everybody. It's why Hegel and Kant thought there was an end of philosophy, because they thought the world was becoming philosophical such that everybody would be able to reflect on themselves. So that it comes back in the 19th century and that we seem to return to this kind of, you know, like politics again, and consequently what was emancipatory in terms of this question of truth, of the objectivity of human subjectivity, like the objectivity of it, instead seems to be like, you know, total relativism or something like that, or like fascism later, you know, because I feel like always with the kind of relativism behind it is the creeping specter of fascism, that you're going to just get this like 2 + 2 = 5, and if you don't like it, we're going to attack you kind of thing. That these things reflect a kind of modern problem that I feel like is beyond simply, you know, conspiratorial thinking, but has like a real, and David, you were mentioning talking to Doug, you know, about why Doug would look to material reality, not looking to the profane realm, but looking to the way in which the world is organized, and maybe a problem with that. But that's me, like when I start hearing truth, I start thinking about politics and the way in which politics is, maybe a lot of people would disagree with what I'm saying, has a kind of demagogical inevitability to it.
So, yeah. So the difference, from my way of thinking, the difference between theories of culture and social construction and theories of social production, or, you know, something like what Henri Lefebvre would talk about in his book, The Production of Space, would be the difference between those who inherently doubt the ability of culture and language and reason to reach a kind of social truth, which would be founded on fundamental equality and cooperation and civility, and instead suspects that all attempts to reason are actually conspiracies garnering and amassing power to impose ways of thinking onto others, and that's what the postmodern turn ended up with, and that's what the cultural turn ended up with, was a suspicion a suspicion that all cultural forms and all attempts to understand were in reality only different ways of being that were incommensurable and which were inherently at odds with each other. So this was sort of the reification of politics, as Danny would describe it in that clip. It was a way of accepting all of our feuds, all of the different rackets, all of the ways in which we're set at odds against each other, rather than a reaching after, a reaching towards a civil society which could cooperate towards an understanding of a truth which could outstrip itself.
So. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot going on here in terms of explaining why that is, like a lot. hence several books and the book that we've got coming up from David Shields trying to get to the bottom of it. But one thing that I mentioned in that podcast that I found very interesting was the way that people panic about people in power. You know, governments have been panicking about disinformation and fake news and so on and controlling this at a time when nothing seems to matter. What people say doesn't seem to matter, where truth appears most relative and where they themselves will also champion narratives in which truth is relative. And that becomes quite progressive. And it reminded me of, you know, a few sort of historical examples where this had happened in the past. So Voltaire, I think it's Voltaire, talks about work is like human activity is so important. And he criticizes sort of reaction, people reacting, religious reactionaries for saying like, oh, well, the problem with humanity is we can't just stay quietly in one room. And Voltaire says, well, we should be happy about that, that inactivity makes us uncomfortable because this is, you know, this is the human spirit. We feel vexed sitting in alone doing nothing because it is not in our nature to be alone and do nothing. But then Voltaire doesn't seem bothered by the fact that nothing that people do during his time seems to be of any consequence, like that most of the occupations that people had were meaningless and didn't give them any meaning. And now we have this, and I gave a few more examples in that podcast, so when people listen to it, you can hear more of the point. But now we have this sort of panic about truth at a time when it doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't seem to matter what you say, you know? And I wonder if part of it, certainly not by any means all of it, is that it's because we're not contesting. As we talked about earlier, there is no alternative. We cannot contest anything that matters. The material world is off the table. How we organize the economy is off the table. I mentioned that I did like a radio interview with Times Radio, and I was making this point, and the interviewer said, well, no, Ashley, Rishi Sunak has suggested a reduction in the 4P income tax rate. And I was like, oh, well, I stand corrected. What big idea? You know, the big ideas that people have are kind of just tinkering with the system as it is. Tinker a bit with the tax system, move this from here to here. That's it. That's the extent. That is the extent of our horizon for change. So when you're not actually contesting anything that matters, what does it matter what you say? Politics can dwell in this world of endless playfulness. Yes, be this, do that. Why not? Who cares? Why not? What do words matter? Call it this, call it that. What do words matter? Because they don't matter, because we're not contesting anything that matters.
Well, there are some realms where what we say and how we think still quite clearly has a material effect. And I have two other things I want to bring up in this stream, but I think I'll save one of them for the Patreon, for the Parrot Room, which is about this New York Times article today about covert Chinese accounts masquerading as Trump supporters online, which I want to address as a part of the question of what is the truth. And, you know, what do we do after the death of God and all of that. But I also got an email from a viewer who had seen our conversation with Megan Murphy after the WPATH files were released that I wanted to address. So if you'll allow me, because this is the realm where, you know, we're invited to make dramatic material changes to ourselves and to our offspring sometimes. So these are excerpts from the email I received, not the entirety of it, but I got an email that said I was disappointed by the way in which you chose to enter the debate around trans issues. Firstly, because I took the WPATH file seriously because of the trust I have in you and Sublation generally when I read it for myself and discovered that it did not rise to any standard of journalism, I felt that my trust had been betrayed. That was the opening or the main point in the opening. And so, unfortunately, the viewer that wrote in didn't make it clear how the WPATH files violated the standards of journalism that we might want to impose or expect. But in an effort to conceal man this claim, I'll let it be known that the files were selected from a relatively open forum that's run by WPATH. So all that's required to participate in the forum is that you pay an annual membership fee. So it's not at all clear that everything and anything on that forum that might be in the WPATH files themselves represents the official opinion of WPATH or represents the actual practices of clinicians. Journalist Jesse Signal stated that he had received the WPATH files a full year before it was published by Schellenberger, and he chose not to report it, not to write it up, not to publicize the leak because of its activist character and how difficult it would be to verify the contents and determine the significance of what was contained within the leak. So there is a question of journalistic standards around the WPATH files, and I'll admit that. However, I think it's worth noting that Jesse also stated that a lot of the conclusions drawn by the WPATH files were already public knowledge, and that one of the primary effects of the leak was to put all the already established facts together in one place. So the various side effects that are often the consequence of puberty blockers, mastectomies, hormonal treatments, and bottom surgeries were already well established in the literature. The fact that the positive consequences of these interventions are difficult to establish and often overstated is also well known. What I found to be new in the WPATH files was the admission from clinicians who are members of WPATH that achieving informed consent was difficult to impossible, especially with younger patients. So all in all, there was enough verifiable information in the WPATH file leaks that I could discover to establish that gender-affirming care as a model fast-tracks patients into experimental treatments with side effects that include sexual dysfunction, and that this is often done without establishing informed consent. And I think that is enough to warrant taking the WPATH files seriously without taking all the editorial comments in the WPATH file seriously, or every single comment that was leaked to be gospel or the absolute official policy of WPATH. I have a clip from Marcy Bowers, who is the president of WPATH, talking about one of the side effects of puberty blockers. And I want to run that clip now to kind of show that you don't have to take my word for it.
The second is was an observation that I had, that every single child who was, or adolescent who was truly blocked at Tanner stage two has never experienced orgasm. I mean, it's really about zero. These are just assigned male at birth. So trans feminine, and it's because they never in their lives are exposed to testosterone. That doesn't change. So blockers prevent the rise of testosterone, and they don't really go on testosterone at or around surgery or into adulthood. And so we don't know. They're going to have this sensation. There's no question about that. But are they going to be able to achieve sexual satisfaction? It's important in relationships. And I know that from my work with female genital mutilation survivors, that the lack of being able to be intimate with a partner is very important. And so this is what really raised the red flag for me, is to say, look, we need to have our eyes open about it. I think it's been beneficial talking about it. I know Joe and many others have reported to me, you know, they've they've changed their approach a little bit in their informed consent models, in that we're talking about masturbation now. We're talking about, okay, that's an area of the body that's got very dysphoric for you, but you know what? It's all a penis is just a large clitoris. I mean, it's all the same material. It really is. So you know, use it for the pleasurable purposes, partially that it was intended, and you know, we'll see what happens. But these are to be answered questions. So, can we avoid puberty and get good adult results? And secondly, how do we assure someone that they're going to be able to be sexually responsive? Do we remove the blockers during the course of their adolescence and let a little bit of puberty come back? Do we delay it a little bit, maybe into Tanner's 3 or 4, maybe before they have their first orgasms, maybe?
So, yeah, so I think it's clear from that clip that, you know, gender affirming care and these interventions come along with it. Fast track patients into experimental treatments.
I mean, that viewer seems to be angry about the editorial part of the report, but I skimmed that. I didn't read that first either. I read that at the end where they put all the leaked documents out. Mm-hmm. That's what I was talking about the whole time. I didn't even pay any attention to the editorial bit, because obviously they got an axe to grind. So I was reading through, and I was very interested. And I wrote about this. If that reader would like to have a look, in Compact, I wrote about the WPATH files. And if you don't have access to Compact, I've posted it somewhere else. But anyway, what I was engaging with was what I found interesting in terms of how the practitioners were dealing with gender affirming care, and the way that they were talking about it as though it was the exact same thing as heart. They use this a few times. They talk about diabetes as a metaphor, and treatment if you had a heart problem. And so in that context, absolutely nothing, no exterior factor can ever get in the way of that, because you've put this on the exact same level as giving someone diabetes medication. So would you withhold diabetes medication from someone who has childhood trauma? No. Would you withhold it from someone who might be gay? No. Someone who has autism? No. Anything at all. Severe mental illness, as was the case in many of that they were talking about, people who were very severely mentally ill. No. Why would you withhold heart medication from someone who's mentally ill? And so this is what, how they were operating. That's what disturbed me. I don't care about the editorial stuff. I think that's a category error, and it's the same error that's made for a lot of psychiatric treatments, and is the basis for my critique of a lot of psychiatric treatments as well, even as I recognize that some of them are necessary. So it is you don't have to read the first part of the report. Leave it. It's fine. Read the end, which was the leak, and then you can go and read the guidelines that were given about eunuchs, about that sort of thing. And you can see that while isolated from any kind of public debate, that it went a bit far, a lot further than most people realize or probably would be ready to accept.
You know, on Twitter, and this, I'm going to mention something that I tried to verify this morning and I couldn't, so I don't know. I thought it was Marcy Bowers who had said it, but I couldn't find the clip of her saying it. But one of the clinicians talked about how in the future we might expect transgender interventions that went beyond the cishet normative binary, and that meant, you know, they mentioned, rather than creating a penis or a vagina, why not a tulip or some other structure that would be erotic and eroticized without fitting into that reproductive model and that schema of the binary. And the science fiction writer in me was like, ha, that's interesting. You know, like that's not to be just immediately rejected as horrific or anything. You know, who knows what the future of humanity might include? Tulip shaped genitals or rose shaped genitals or what have you. But at the same time, I was reminded of an old Woody Allen short story that its premise was, what if Van Gogh had, instead of becoming an artist, to become a dentist, and the horrific results that would have occurred in the mouths of his patients as he, you know, was tired of simply filling cavities and cleaning teeth, but wanted to create whole new patterns of molars and change the shape of the mouth and to fit his vision and so forth. And that the torture that his patients would have been put through, it was a comedic piece, of course. So there is a balance here between our imagination and the kinds of freedoms that we might want to chase after, and the real medical consequences of that kind of experimentation on real life people today. But I also wanted to speak very briefly to another objection that the viewer raised, which was that they were disappointed with the guests that we selected for that, which were, they said, you chose to discuss this with the most predictable so-called TERFs. Not what they actually said. I was disappointed to discover that you chose to go along with the most boring and predictable so-called TERF critique, uncritically labeling transgenderism an ideology as if there was no Zizek, taking up the call for women's spaces without delving into the history of such spaces in feminist theory, taking up the ideas of Ray Blanchard to paint most trans women as sexual deviants as if there was no Lacan, the contemporary insistence on the strict separation of biological sex, gender identity, and sexual orientation can certainly be critiqued, but this is a pernicious way to go about it. So I wanted to respond to that and say, first of all, starting with Blanchard, it's worth remembering that he was an advocate and is an advocate for gender transition as a medical intervention, and he did not seek to stigmatize trans people with his research. Judging autogynephilia as antisocial or dangerous was not his aim. It's not anything he ever did. Further, we sought guests who were already talking about the WPATH files with the assurance that to speak to them did not require us to assent to all their ideas. And I was grateful to Megan Murphy and Andrew Doyle for giving us some of their time. But I didn't find myself agreeing with either of them entirely. And I don't think you did either. Ashley, you might have agreed with some things more than I did. I don't think that the way most of the left has approached the question of gender-affirming care and transgender identity overall. I do think that the way we approach these issues will have to be revised in light of the evidence of malpractice that is emerging. But just how we're going to do that, what kind of revisions we'll make, it is not entirely clear. I hope that it's done in the context of a struggle for civil liberties and civil rights, and a struggle against the power of the state to constrain people's personal expression that can be universalized. And that's my answer to the
email. Yeah, so I'm gonna be like the most boring kind of like, this is the conservative Hegel. I was just talking about this actually with my patrons. So we do like group Q&As, and we were talking about what I thought about these extremes, and I thought it was really unhelpful that the debate had come to these kinds of extremes where both sides will be like completely unwilling to talk to each other, utterly villainize each other. And I think that it doesn't have to be that way. Like, of all the things in the world to be like, take up arms, I don't think bathrooms is like the the one. But on the other hand, I am grateful for people who do articulate the extremes, all the way from eunuchs to every trans person is a pedophile, whatever, because at least they're putting it all out, the extremes of where this could all go. And we can go, no, 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 no. And if you just kind of stick your fingers in your ears and pretend none of that is happening, we never make it any further in this debate. So I don't think that it is helpful to, and what I found very interesting too, is I also spoke with Robin Moira White, who is a trans woman and a trans advocate, a trans rights advocate and a barrister on my channel. And I found it interesting that Robin, how she responded to the main thing that the gender critical feminists hate, which is this notion that it is potentially a fetish, that being recognized as a woman, then you being forced to recognize a man as a woman is part of a fetish. First of all, they don't like to have to be forced to do that. But second of all, that it's like a misogynistic way of getting off. That's the extreme bit, right? Now, Robin said, no, there's no such thing as that. And autogynephiles, they're not really trans. She didn't say that, but she kind of went in that direction. Like, I don't know, maybe there are some of these people in the world and I think they're pretty sad individuals is kind of what she said. And I don't think that's helpful either, to just deny that that exists, because the gender critical feminists are pulling it up constantly. I mean, they are just like fucking, 24 hours a day posting this stuff. They're going all over Reddit. They're all over the internet. They're all over perversion. They're out there. So you know that it exists. It might be a small thing, but it's probably something that needs to be talked about, because they're going to extreme ends to paint all trans people as that. Now we have to be able to have some kind of nuanced conversation which recognizes that there are all sorts of reasons that lead to trans identities. And simply denying and saying that there's just one thing, some kind of essence, doesn't help either, because people are going to start to question that. So we need to be able to have these open conversations. And in that way, I'm quite glad for, unfortunate though it is, I don't think it had to get this far, but I'm glad for the people who articulate the extremes, because then we can say, no, I don't want that. I don't want that. But there has to be something. So there's my boring middle ground position. But I think on this particular issue, I think that we do need to kind of stop being so ridiculous about it, because it's got so extreme where it's like, I'll take your kids away when I come into power, and take your kids away if you affirm them and use their pronouns and give them hormones and blah blah blah. And it's like, no, when we come to power, we're gonna take your kids away if you don't affirm them. And like, oh my gosh, can we please find some, we need to be able to have an open conversation. Something, a cultural phenomenon is happening. That is the case. It is multifactorial. It is multi-causal. We need to find a way through this. And what I had said to my patrons when we were having that discussion is that, as with a lot of these things, like, before we kind of come through it with clear heads, it'll probably fade away. That's that's what happens with a lot of these things. I don't know.
I think it will keep coming back. Sam Badger says, Doug, wouldn't it solve the problem to get on a trans leftist to provide a broader discussion, though I kind of agree with Dr. Forbin, who said, can we please get off the trans wagon? I'm not even sure what that means. Do you think I'm pro-trans?
I should also say that we did invite on many trans activists who didn't respond. Robin's the only one who responded positively. I don't know how people feel about this, but I'm talking to Buck Angel and Debbie Hayton this week. And so, you know, all sorts of people, because I myself am trying to sort through what I think about this, what I think is going on. So I am just curious about what all these different voices have to say.
My particular take on all this is, like, I kind of side with Lou Reed as much as possible, who wrote, Take a Walk on the Wild Side, that there's something emancipatory about dressing up in drag and also dangerous and sometimes antisocial about that whole scene. That's certainly the one that Lou Reed described in that song, which came along with, you know, drug use and drug addiction and poverty and all the rest, right? But I'm not sitting in judgment on people who might be autogynephilic or just cross dressers and having fun or any of that. And I want to, you know, remember that, hey, you know, the idea of being on the left is also to be a civil libertarian as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, exactly. And the question is, how do we move through this while respecting liberties on all sides?
I am concerned about medical malpractice, though. I mean, if people are not being well informed about interventions that they're being offered, they're being fast tracked into interventions which are often debilitating in some way, or could be, and they're not being informed, that's not something to be ignored. So, but we listen.
Somebody's laughing. LOL, Buck Angel. I like Buck Angel. I do. I think there are some aspects of what he says that I think don't make sense, but I generally like him. So.
Yeah, someone says Lou Reed also wrote Heroin, which is another great song, by the way. All right.
Okay, so there are a few other things. So to kind of sum up, we said humanity is searching for a moral compass. We're sort of set adrift. This is where we are now. I tried to kind of offer a bunch of different people's solutions to it. And I hoped that if we could find that purpose in the future, if we can have a goalpost set in the future of bridging the chasm between what is and what ought to be, this can give us some kind of anchor. I might have missed that bit, but that is what I would suggest as the outcome for that I think part of how we're sort of lost in this abyss and we're in this politics of the void is because we've lost that anchor in the future, which was made possible with sort of modernity and so on, that we're no longer bound by fate. We can move into the future, and that future can be under human control. We witnessed the first results of that. They weren't good. Now the anchor is in the self, and the self is being degraded, and we're stuck in this sort of like wishy-washy world where anything goes. Hey, maybe we could have a politics where words matter if what you say leads somewhere that goes bad or good. I don't know. The other thing is we got some criticism for our the way that we handled the WPATH files. We said go read the files, and we're trying to talk to as many people as possible. In the Patreon, we're going to talk about war, cats, dogs.
Dogs and cats lying together. Mass hysteria. That's what I wrote down. We're going to be talking about, I want to talk about this article in the New York Times about the covert Chinese accounts that are masquerading online as American supporters of former President Donald Trump.
Oh, yes.
And so there's a lot to discuss there. Headline, though, just a too long didn't read version. It's the intelligence agencies turning the New York Times into a mouthpiece for them.
It also feeds into the broader themes this week, which is about truth, that someone had suggested, I can't remember the darned article, but I read it over the weekend, where somebody had suggested that part of the sort of young people playing with identity is that they are in this world, the online world, where especially nothing seems to have consequence. You can be what you want and endlessly kind of mold and your identity and so on. So everything is up in the air. And here you go. Like, you could be talking to somebody, you think that they're a Trump supporter, but they're actually in a Chinese social media farm. So what does it matter? Anything goes. We are in the topsy-turvy world of the internet. So stay tuned. Join us on the Patreon, and you can come into the chat, ask us questions, and hold our feet to the fire? What's with me? I can never get
Hold our feet to the fire. Oh, the other thing we're going to do, if we have time in the Patreon, is I have this theory that while Americans know nothing about other countries, that everybody, especially in the English-speaking world, actually knows enough about America to be citizens. And I'm going to give Ashley a 10 to 20 question practice test to see if you
fail miserably. Fail. Like, whenever you guys talk about American politics, I'm like, oh, you Americans, you think you're the center of the universe. But it's mainly because I know nothing about America. Not nothing, but like very little about American politics. It's a weak spot for me. So watch me fail a citizenship test brutally.
All right, here we go.
In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people